From WXXI News, this is Connections. I'm Evan Dawson. This week, we've heard from local civil rights organizers and activists. We've heard from the women who led the demonstrations on Saturday and are helping lead the calls for reform in policing in Rochester and across New York State and the country. We've had conversations about possible reforms and specific ideas in American policing. And today we've reached out to local leadership to find out if they are open to such reforms. This hour, we welcome Mike Mazzio, the president of the Rochester Police Locust Club, who is on the line with us now. Mike, welcome. How are you?
I'm good. Thank you. Good afternoon.
Well, Mike, you know, I mean, I think it's been a busy and tough 4 days for a lot of people. And I think the community is obviously hurting. I think there are people across the country who not only see these events, but they're wondering if they're going to produce anything that looks like actual progress. So let me just kind of go down a list of specific questions and reforms. After I ask you out of the gate here, do you think any RPD officers acted inappropriately during the events on Saturday? Let's go back to Saturday. Did any RPD officers act inappropriately in dealing with crowds?
Well, I say from what I saw and what I'm aware of, there's no indications. I've heard no complaints in that sense. And I think we have to remember that in those situations and the way those officers are trained, they take no action without being a direct order or command from above them. No one's taken any individual actions. So if they took any actions, they were told to do so. And I think that's important for everyone to know and hear.
But don't you think officers have their own agency and accountability in those moments? I mean, I think everybody, you're right, has to deal with training, but you're still making your own decisions on those individual moments, aren't you?
No, you're not. You're not really. Depending on what we're talking about here, if we're, you know, on a line and we're given an order to deploy pepper ball rounds or whatever, those are all commands and orders that are given. Anything direction. That's why it's so important in those situations, because there's so much stress and you're dealing with so much. And you can see it if you look in the videos, that they're constantly changing the officers that are on the line up. So no one's standing there dealing with anything for any, you know, long period of time. Keep stress levels down, keep emotions down. And they work on this and they practice that for these type of events. And I watched it very carefully, and, you know, it was a very, very difficult situation for everybody that day, no doubt about it.
Well, I don't disagree. It's a difficult situation, but I want to make sure I understand what you're saying about, you know, taking actions and orders and relying on training, because when we look at, and I'll just give you a couple of examples. I'm trying to be careful when I cite examples because I know video can come out of context or it could maybe not include all of the things that led up to it. But when you see, for example, an NYPD car drive into a crowd of people, there's nobody who thinks that that was based on training or any valuable order. I mean, that's an officer in a moment in New York City who is frustrated. And yeah, maybe people are banging on the car or smacking the windshield. But to drive into a crowd of people, I don't think that comes from training, just as in Kansas City, when there is a line of peaceful protesters in broad daylight, an officer comes over, puts a woman around the neck and sprays her in the face, point blank. Did she say something he didn't like? I can't imagine that's based on training or orders. That's why I think in those moments, you still have to be able to hold individuals accountable, right?
Oh, well, let's be fair here, Evan. We went from one conversation talking, or at least I thought I was talking about Rochester right here and what took place. This is the biggest problem now with social media and media coverage is we're not talking about the neighborhood. We're not talking about our city. We're talking about the world. And, you know, from dealing with these and similar situations over the years, how difficult it is to get anything done or get people to cooperate and move forward. Now we've multiplied that by 1,000 times, taking the world into play as well. When I made a statement that I saw nothing wrong, let me be clear. I was referencing our people and what I was focused on during the weekend.
Yeah, no. Listen, I'm taking your point, but you're saying I saw nothing wrong, but anything those officers did, they're not making their own decisions. It's based on training and orders. Whereas all I'm saying is there's plenty of examples of officers who have made individual decisions, and I don't think you can say there's no officers who do anything individually, right? I mean, it's not just based on training and orders. They're going to have to rely on themselves in certain moments to decide, do I handle this situation in X or Y manner? I assume they've got options and choices, and it sounds like you think they don't.
No, I didn't say that. You know, to be fair here, now we're talking a couple of different levels here and a couple of different circumstances. I was referencing, I thought we were talking about the incidents in front of the public safety building. No, and in fact, for the rest of the night and into the weekend, we had officers that were deployed all over the city and were responding to the various calls and were called quick response teams and so forth. So, of course, in those situations, there are supervisors with those teams, but those teams have to go out and, you know, they have to take their actions based on their training and what they believe they need to do at that moment. Was there things that were done that you say, are individual or were wrong? I didn't want to get into a point. I think we were trying to defend this whole situation here. I'll try to do it the best I can, but I think that's part of the problem with this, what we've been dealing with for years. We keep getting stalemated by attacks and then defending and going back and forth, and we never get to a step forward.
All right, so all right, well,
I'll deal with those questions. Anything that you need or
okay.
Clarify.
No, all right, so let's talk about individual reform efforts. There's one that it sounds like right out of the gate you're on board with, and we just heard you talking about 50A. For people who don't know what 50A is, why don't you give it a brief description, Mike, and why you are in favor of its repeal?
Well, you know, what was interesting, I think I heard, you know, some on your show the other day, very, very passionate about removing 50A. And then I think you asked a couple follow-up questions or in reference to what Governor Cuomo had said. And then, you know, it was like, well, don't really understand that. And that's the biggest problem, I think, with 50A. You know, 50A makes their individual records secure, per se. And that was, you know, put into legislation quite a few years back. And obviously, for whatever reasons, the intent of that law was. But the reality is, now, anytime an officer goes to testify in any action in a criminal justice system, attorneys in that can request their disciplinary records. A judge will review, and you know, in the last couple of years, we've seen pretty much everything. Anytime the request was asked, turned over. So that's being done in that setting. And then in our own what we call civil service section 75 hearings, the hearing officer is giving the background on prior discipline, and when he makes his determination or recommendation, he can make an inference to any past disciplinary actions that are similar in nature, and that comes into play as well. And I think that's one of the biggest parts that people don't understand. They look at 50A and they think it's a shield that protects cops with extensive disciplinary records, you know, and protects them from being disciplined or whatever the case is. I argue with all sides on this, and you mentioned I have arguments with other police unions, because I think we're in a point in time when we look at that this law is really has no teeth to it in the sense that what everyone believes. Other states, you know, Florida has complete open sunshine, and they still have issues and problems as well. So I don't think having it open or closed would make a huge difference per se. But I think there's, you know, the questions, and I think they got to be answered in both sides. What's the reasoning to have certain things public? Is it so anytime any officer is involved in anything that we just have something to throw onto social media and try to taint things or make things look more hyped up or whatever. And I think that's why some unions are guarded about it. I think it opens up a better discussion and a bigger discussion about making the process fair and holding everyone strongly accountable. And, you know, right now, in our disciplinary hearings, it's only a recommendation by a hearing officer, and then it goes to the appointing authority, who is usually chief of police. So, you know, an officer can be exonerated in the hearing by all the evidence that's brought back and forth, like any other trial-type setting. And then the appointing authority can say, I'm not going with that recommendation, and here it is. Or a police chief can say, you can plead to 30 days guilty on this, or you can go to a hearing and you're going to get terminated no matter what. That creates a problem. And, you know, I think fixing that, making it fair, making it neutral, I think would work hugely into helping some of our issues and problems.
All right,
so that's the discussion. That's simple, but we can make reforms, and we should.
Okay. Mary Lupien is a member of Rochester City Council. She writes the following this morning, quote, as a small part of the fight for one of the most progressive police accountability boards in the country, I refused to seek donations from law enforcement PACs, including our Rochester Police Locust Club. I am now calling on all legislators locally to refuse future contributions and return past contributions. We cannot let money influence our actions during this critical time for reform. I would like to applaud my colleagues, Mitch Gruber, Malik Evans, and Jackie Ortiz, who have already demonstrated leadership in committing to donating past contributions to organizations, and she highlights several of them locally. She says, I will push more legislators to follow their lead. So, Mike, as the president of the Rochester Police Union, why are you giving money to political candidates?
Well, understand there's a number of reasons, and those include protections, pensions, training, and let's go back to what any union does for their membership, and ensure safety, ensure a number of benefits and so forth for the members. But also, let's go back in the history of New York State. It was police unions that were finally able to form in a collective bargaining sense in the 70s that pushed for stringent requirements in hiring and training and setting standards. And sometimes you can see vastly the difference between New York State and other states that might be right to work that don't have those abilities. We've accomplished a lot.
But do you understand why people say now, let's just get police money out of politics, get it out?
Well, what money that have we given locally that has any influence, or is certainly in the PAB? I see nothing there on how we influence anything.
So you're arguing that you give money to political candidates, but you get nothing for it?
We support and endorse, and many times I stay in solidarity with our area labor council as well, because it's important, depending on if we have state representatives, and we're not part of a federal PAC, so we don't deal on that level. We have a lobbying organization, NAPO, that we're a part of and affiliated with. But on a state level, there's a number of issues for that. And a lot of them deal with getting legislation. We had an officer that was struck by a car directing traffic. And for 19 years, we had tried to get him the public safety officer benefits that he was entitled to. Those are the type of stuff as well. I don't see anything that we've done in a negative sense to try to influence something, especially in the city, by money. And we don't even have that type of money. We're an independent local bargaining unit.
Okay,
we're not
well,
affiliate.
I hear you. I'm hearing from Councilwoman Lupien, among many others, saying let's get money out of politics from police. Let me read a Pew study, Mike. Pew 2017 study on the broader question of overall race relations in American society. 92% of white American police officers, 92%, say that the United States has made the changes needed to give blacks equal rights with whites. 29% of black police officers agree. Now, let me look at the general population. 57% of white Americans agree that we've given enough work to race relations. 57% of the general population, 92% of white officers, 12% of the black population, 29% of black officers. So officers in general are out of step with the general population, but white officers are way out of step. Why are white police officers so out of step with the rest of the country on the subject of whether this country has done enough regarding race?
Well, listen, that is an important topic, and that's an important thing to look at as well. I actually spoke because we do a lot of internal organizing. My members, if you speak to them individually, a number of them sometimes don't like what I say in our general membership meetings, but it's important. That's what labor organizations do, and there's a reason for what we stand for, to end injustice and inequality. I spoke specifically with other labor leaders on this, and not police unions. And we found that we found more common issues along this line within their organization. So regardless of if there are the industry is law enforcement or the trades or GM workers and so forth, these polls come out this way very close, or maybe in some cases even worse as well. That's a bigger question. How, you know, as a union member, you should be hearing the right things. You should be directed to the right way, and you should be living part of that in solidarity for what you need as well. And that is frustrating. It's frustrating across the board, without any doubt. But we also are making inroads as well. When we have these issues and we have these discussions, I think that this is about as easy as getting the answer to the common cold. I mean, it seems like we ought to be able to fix it, but we just can't make it go away.
I think it's pretty complex, actually, don't you?
Oh, absolutely. Absolutely. And isn't it so much harder now with this technology we got? And like I said, we're dealing with the whole world at our fingertips.
Well, you keep blaming social media, but I'm not sure the world would know about George Floyd, and we maybe not see the urgency of these demonstrations if not for social media.
I think social media, in one sense, has been very positive. And in other sides, it's been equally destructive or divisive in terms of misinformation.
That can be true. Facts. I just don't think Twitter is why white officers are out of step with the rest of the population on race. But I understand the point. I just don't see how it connects to why police are out of step.
Well, we keep going back to this and the discussions that I listened to before. And I don't, honestly, I really don't feel that the answer to all this is to try to here and defend stuff. I think we're beyond that. But I also listened to something that was very, very, very one-sided in every conversation, painting everybody in law enforcement as being this or that. And man, we got to back off that a little bit. We can make some improvements, but continuing in this line or continuing in discussions, it's simply casted as all one and all racist and all this and all that. We have to get beyond that here.
Mike Mazzio,
we're just going to be where we're.
Mike Mazzio is president of the Rochester Police Locust Club. Congressman Justin Amash is a former Republican. He's now a Libertarian. He's put forward a bill to get rid of qualified immunity. It's a judicial doctrine that essentially protects police officers who violate someone's constitutional rights from civil lawsuits, unless the officer's actions were clearly established as already unconstitutional when the action was committed. And the U.S. Supreme Court has essentially over time made this so narrow that officers have almost entire qualified immunity and they can't get sued. Justin Amash, again, former Republican, now a Libertarian, he's put forward this bill. There are Democrats who are supporting it. There are Republicans who are supporting it. Do you support it, Mike?
Well, I've I do have some concerns on it. And, you know, part of it is on, I have to see a level of protection in terms of allegations and how do we deal. I mean, is there a way to deal on the, does the process go forward in a civil action? And when do we determine maybe indemnification of the officer? You know, how do we prevent numerous actions going forward on an officer? You know, it seems like a simple and easy legislation to pass, but just in that, there's been a number of different conversations. You know, we have it here in the city in the number of civil allegations or claims against the city. And, you know, a number of them are never resolved. They're simply settled. And, you know, that's a complaint we've had for a number of years, that we should be calling some of these civil actions that are going forward out and get to the truth, whatever the truth is. But we tend to settle too many more just on a cost basis. And I think that adds to this problem.
But why should police officers have a special immunity that the rest of the population doesn't have?
I think it's in the type of job or work we do. You know, we talk about misconduct. We also talk about mistakes as well. Is a mistake the same as misconduct? Is there intent in the actions? And a police officer's actions sometimes could lead to a civil claim, an action that he against him for an action he's taken as a police officer. If he's involved in, I hate to use shooting, but that's probably the easiest one to show as an example, gets involved in some situation, and then maybe somebody not involved in that confrontation is struck, not intentionally, but because of the actions, he's liable on that. And that's what the protections are for. I don't think they were ever set up to protect police officers from doing anything they want and not be civilly sued.
Well,
that was not the intent of it.
Well, if that wasn't the intent of it, I think there is a call from Congressman Amash and many others that that's what this has become. And I think what you're describing for listeners, Mike, is, I mean, I understand it can be extraordinarily stressful work, but if you have a situation where officers of the state are armed and someone could be grossly injured or die in a mistake, I want them to be trained so well that the mistakes are vanishingly minimal. And that's a high standard. I agree that's a high standard. But at the same time, we have a situation where people now feel like, led by Congressman Amash, this is not a lefty, this is not an activist, this is a libertarian, a former Republican, saying what's ended up happening is that this law has allowed police to be sloppy and occasionally someone could die and they say, well, it was a mistake. And the U.S. Supreme Court protects you and you can't get sued. And he says, not anymore. This is the moment where we say that has gone too far in that direction. Are you prepared in at all to sort of give credence to those who feel that way, whether it's Congressman Amash or others?
Yeah, and understand, I'm giving you a perspective here that has not been given before, and that's what I feel I need to do. But what you're speaking about is a great example. The reason for the indemnification, and we're talking local, and it's different from the immunity on a federal level as well. And our people would probably not even qualify unless they're deputized under a federal agency or so forth on that. But locally, the indemnification goes to the city, so the responsibility is on to the city to ensure that they maintain those training standards and all of the requirements and keep standards up and ensure that their people are up to speed and well-trained and continue to train as well. If you were to take that and remove that, listen, we argue and have discussions all the time about the lack of training, and it usually ends up on budget issues. So then it comes down to a budget issue versus what we should be doing. So there's protections in place in this as well, at least locally on our indemnification side. And that's important.
All right. let me get a couple more quick points in, and then we're going to go to audience feedback here. So this is from the Washington Post today, quoting from the Washington Post. Since 2006, the nation's largest police departments have fired at least 1,881 police officers for misconduct that betrayed the public's trust, from cheating on overtime to unjustified shootings. But the Washington Post has found that departments have been forced to reinstate more than 450 of those officers after appeals required by union contracts. And the Post goes on to say, right now there's a national call to abolish police unions from just about every political quarter. Reason Magazine, a libertarian publication, calling to abolish. Local civil rights activists who led protests this past weekend, making the same call. The New Republic, Salon, the Federalist, left, right. They say police unions are the single biggest reason that some of the officers who have already committed acts abusing people and sometimes even shooting or killing people can still get rehired or are forced to get rehired. Do you acknowledge that, Mike? I mean, the public perception right now is that police unions are protecting officers who have already done wrong and make it very hard to fire. Is that wrong?
It's wrong. I'll tell you what, and I'm glad. This is a great question to bring forward. And then again, to look at what we have here. You're going to find that problem and that issue to be predominantly in right-to-work states or states that don't have strong civil service laws as well. And you're not going to find that in New York State, and the numbers will not support that as well. We have a certification process in this state that pretty much for the most part prevents that. What we do have is the ability, and it's very narrow in scope, if somebody is terminated, to be able to file an Article 78 appeal. And it's very limited, and it's not like you can go in and argue that the proof was not or was wrong in your disciplinary hearing. There's only a very narrow factor that you can appeal to. But that is a problem, and that's part of when we had these discussions that we should look back at what labor has done and what the legislation in the state has done, being a unionized state, and be thankful for it. You will not find in right-to-work states, unions have tremendous amount of funds that are in those areas. We don't on those. To put that in perspective, now, should there be change? Yes. Does it affect us here in the state? I don't believe so. And I don't think you'll see it. And that's why I think it's good for some of the transparency in some of these laws to be lifted and for the public to actually see. Transparency is important.
I think everyone wants transparency. How about removal of military gear from all police departments? There's a bipartisan group of members of Congress who want to change what they call the pipeline from the Pentagon to local police when it comes to tactical and military gear.
Yeah, this is another very you could take both sides on this as well.
I'm asking you to take one side.
Well, I need, and I just did this, had a discussion yesterday with the chief about having equipment and having safety in the workplace like any worker should have. And we're dealing in situations that we find ourselves in never before. We're dealing with firearms and automatic weapons and assault that we never had before to worry about. And we're in a global world issue where situations occur. And it becomes difficult to say we shouldn't have it, but what happens when the day we need it and we don't have it? I think we're very careful. This is a question more for the chief, but I'll speak to it. In what situations anything like that is even used? If it's high risk for whatever information they have, they may use an armored vehicle to go to do a search warrant or whatever warrant they have to operate. Do I think we should be driving down the street looking like military? That's martial law, and that's not what it's for. And if there's departments doing that, that is wrong. But what do we do in certain situations that we have to find ourselves in? And this goes back, and this started back in L.A. when we had a bank robbery where people were fully outfitted in bulletproof equipment, had automatic weapons, and they wrecked havoc on a city in one day. I think that's where we started to see a change. And then as the globalization of the world came, with the issues that we have with terrorist organizations and so forth, I think there was a need it's got to be checked, though. It's got to be in place, and I think everybody should be in agreement with that.
Do you describe the death of George Floyd as a murder, Mike?
I don't know what else you can describe it on. I mean, that. Okay. I really want to know and hear, and I don't know if we'll ever get that. What was going on there? What was going through their minds, or what was that officer doing?